WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Tropical storm Idalia is getting stronger, and it could become a major hurricane when it reaches Florida's Gulf Coast on Wednesday. Governor Ron DeSantis has declared a widespread state of emergency ahead of the storm. Tampa resident John Gray lined up for sandbags.
If you prepare for it, then you're ready.
CBS's Christopher Cruz reports that Tampa's airport is closing at midnight.
Officials say the closure will allow them to secure jet bridges, ground equipment, and aircraft before the storm's expected landfall early Wednesday.
Tampa International Airport is extremely close to Tampa Bay, and storm surge and flooding are obviously a top concern for us.
John Tiliakos is the head of operations at the airport.
Let me be clear, impacting people's travel plans is not something we take lightly, and suspending flight operations is a last resort.
The airport says some cargo and private aircraft operations may continue overnight, but all air traffic will cease by 7 o'clock Tuesday morning. Christopher Cruz, CBS News.
Also, the National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Franklin is about 440 miles west-southwest of Bermuda, with maximum sustained winds of 150 miles per hour. No motive known after a deadly shooting on the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill campus. It happened in a science lab building. Police Chief Brian James.
Police discovered one individual, a faculty member, had been shot. Unfortunately, as we have reported, this person is deceased.
A suspect is in custody. A lockdown was in place for some 3 hours before being lifted. A weekend shooting in Jacksonville, Florida is being investigated as a hate crime. Three black people were killed by a white gunman at a Dollar General store on Saturday. CBS's Manuel Bojorquez is in Jacksonville, where a clearer picture of the victims is coming to light.
The three victims are 52-year-old Angela Carr, 19-year-old A.J. Laguerre, and 29-year-old Gerald Gallion, who had a 4-year-old daughter.
It's not fair.
LaTiffany Gallion is the victim's sister.
He was a loving guy.
A loving guy.
He was a devoted father. He'd do anything for his daughter.
Parents are concerned about the spread of COVID as children go back to school, and the White House has a message for them. CBS's Linda Kenyon has more.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says this administration is ready.
We believe that we're prepared for the fall. We believe that we're in a better position than we've ever been to combat COVID-19.
And she says since no one wants to see more COVID-related shutdowns, especially when it comes to the schools, vaccines are important.
We are going to continue to encourage folks to be updated on their vaccine, the RSV, let's not forget, make sure they get that, and also the flu vaccine.
Linda Kenyon, CBS News, the White House.
This is CBS News.
You need to hire fast and hire right? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. A bicyclist who was injured after crashing and falling down an embankment was saved by Eau Claire Fire Rescue on Saturday morning. According to an Eau Claire Fire Rescue Facebook post, the bicyclist fell down an embankment near Galloway Street in Eau Claire around 9 a.m. on Saturday. First responders used a rigging system to rescue the biker, and they were then transported to the hospital. The director of the Cedarburg Art Museum in Racine County has been accused of embezzling $100,000 from a school for students with special needs that had listed her as its principal. Heather Wentholt is facing counts of embezzlement, misdemeanor bail jumping, felony personal ID theft, and a count of computer crimes in relation to the destruction of data. The complaint alleges that despite being listed as a full-time principal, Wentholt only visited the school 5 times during the 2022-2023 school year. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898. But 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
Air pollution and emissions, and officials say they're cheaper to operate. And finally, in Ecuador, in a historic national referendum, Ecuadorians voted overwhelmingly to ban oil drilling in Yasuni National Park in the Amazon rainforest, one of the most diverse biospheres in the world. It's hailed as a historic example of climate democracy, and it was also a victory for indigenous peoples and conservationists.
I will share that hailing. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. What an interesting moment we are in the Biden administration. And I've been saying for the longest time, I voted for Joe Biden because he is a workers' president, because he is firmly on the ground of fighting for working people and people's ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. And his NLRB, his Treasury Department, his vice president, all of those folks moving in the right direction. And I point to today, the big report put out by the White House task force, headed up by Vice President Kamala Harris, that said, hey, guess what? You know that thing Rick Smith's been talking about for 18 years on the radio? How our unions get higher wages, better benefits, better opportunities, how it's good for the economy? Well, they've got a report out today that says just that. Now, they didn't need the Treasury Department to do a big report and spend a lot of time in researching and investigating. They did, but they didn't need to do that. They could have just asked me. And I would have been more than happy to tell them exactly what all of us already know. And for me, the importance of this report, and I'm not mocking the administration because no president in my lifetime has done this before. This is an opportunity to go, look, we've done our homework. We've done the research. We've looked into it. This is the pathway forward. And this is kind of what this marks for the administration. Now, I've been saying all along, all through his presidency, there are moments when the NLRB head makes a decision that moves in a good direction. He said, this is the reason you voted for Biden, to ensure that working people get a fair shot. But like I said, this report, you know, as Kamala Harris said, union workers earn 15% more in pay than non-union workers in the same occupation. Union workers also receive retirement benefits, paid sick leave, life insurance, discounts on child care. And I would add, which I think she forgot to mention, health insurance at a much, much higher rate and better health insurance. So for me, this is extremely encouraging because this is saying that what we've been doing here at the program for all these years is filtering in, saying, hey, and I ask this question a lot. Which are you? Are you a worker first or are you a consumer first? And I know it's a chicken or egg scenario, but it really is telling when you have people who answer it. And what I have found over the 18 years of asking that very simple question is I don't need to ask you who you voted for in the last election. I know by the answer of that question. If you say I'm a worker first because it's how I make my living, it's how I support my family, it's how I get all of these things, chances are, overwhelmingly, you vote for a Democrat. If you're a consumer first and it's all about, you know, cheap goods and hooray for me, chances are you're going the other direction. And it's this hyper individualist. I'm not quite sure what the rationale is, but that's how it's broken out for me. So to have Biden come up and say, look, we're breaking from the past. We're breaking from all of the supply side voodoo Reaganomics. We're breaking from neoliberalism. We're going to start making things here. We're going to start investing here. We're going to start bringing jobs back here. And we're going to make sure that those workers, when those jobs come back, make a decent living. Make a good living to where work actually pays. And, you know, because I go back to the Reagan era. Reagan always said, you know, the best anti-poverty program is a job. And I've always amended that to say, no, not just a job, because there are a lot of McJobs out there, but a union job, one with superior wages, benefits, all that stuff. This is what the administration is picking up. And this is what they're moving forward. And that is a good thing. And again, I come back to the idea that this administration, and say what you want about Biden. And look, I've got problems with his inability to give a speech. I've got problems with, you know, all kinds of, it's his policies. It's the direction that he is slowly, quietly moving this country. I wish we were a little louder about it, and I will be loud for him because I think he is doing the right things. We've got to say this is what we want, though. Because remember, you go back to the Trump era. This is what I have a problem with my working class Trump folks, because Biden is doing exactly what they believed Donald Trump was going to do. Take on China, reshore manufacturing, invest in infrastructure, all of those things that my union brothers and sisters who were waving the red flag and wearing the red hat were saying were important to them, Biden is doing. So it's one thing to have a PR stunt. It's one thing to do your photo op, you know, wear the funny little hat, drive the little truck, do whatever he's going to do. It's one thing to have Trump's show. It's another thing to just quietly pick up your jelly bucket and get to work. And I tell you, that's what Jelly Bucket Joe has been doing, man. And I give him credit for it. Now, the business community, not thrilled. Because what this means is their hands are no longer planted at 10 and 2 on the steering wheel. They are no longer in complete control. This idea that workers should have some voice, they're not taking well. And you look at what happened on Friday for all my union brothers and sisters. Friday was an important day because those who have listened to the show know that I've said for years that the way my grandparents' generation organized unions to where they got up to 35% union density and created the most prosperous, wealthiest working class in the history of civilization, how they did it was a government that encouraged people to join and form unions, bargain collectively for the profits that were extracted from consumers, and make their lives better. I've always said that. And I've always said that the law has to be slightly tilted towards workers, as the NLRA is, to make sure that workers have a shot. Because what the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, understood is that the employer has all the rights, has all the power, has all the control. They control what you do, when you do it, how you do it, where, how, what, why, when, all that stuff. They control every aspect of your day. Employees, workers, needed a little balance. And that's what the NLRA did, gave them the opportunity to say, hey, we want to have some say in the workplace. That is a good thing. And Biden's moving us back to this. Now, the decision on Friday, the announcement Friday by the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is saying we're going to change some things up. We're going to return to some old ideas that worked really well. And one of them is this Cemex decision that is going to, the hope, break down on union busting. Because currently, if you're an employer and your workers want to organize, you're going to go out and you're going to hire a union busting firm who, to be honest, it would be malpractice for them not to tell you to break the law. Because the penalties are so minuscule, and the payoff is so big, it would be malpractice not to. What this is now saying is, look, if your workers come to the employer and say, we've got the cards, we've got our intention is to form a union, a company has the ability to, one, recognize that and begin bargaining. And that's what happened a lot in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Two, they can demand an election, and that has to be done in a timely fashion without harassment and intimidation and firing workers and unfair labor practices. Now, if the employer says, hey, we're going to demand this election, and they break the rules. And the big one was Amazon in Birmingham, Alabama. You may remember us talking about how they were plastering things in the bathroom stalls, how they had cameras everywhere, how the ballot box was a mailbox that they dropped and had cameras all over it, all kinds of unfair labor practices. And I said at the time that the NLRB should impose the union upon them. That, sorry, you screwed the election up. You have tainted the pool. It's over. You now have to begin bargaining. That's what this does. This is potentially a game changer to help people organize and fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and to be able to, I don't know, think of themselves as workers first, making sure that their pockets have enough money in it to put food on the table, a roof over their kids' head, opportunities for the future, healthcare, retirement security, the things that we as working people view as that American dream, what my generation viewed as almost a birthright going into the workplace. This is, to steal a Joe Bidenism, a big freaking deal. And the hope is that we move on this. Now, this is an election issue too. Because as the administration has done this, as they have put people into these positions to make these decisions, Donald Trump, Vivek Ramaswamy, Ron DeSantis, any Republican, you know, generic Republican top to bottom, is going to come in and completely undo this. For working people, this should be a voting issue. This should be a huge voting issue, because this is how you support your family. This is that kitchen table economics stuff. This is the stuff that gives you opportunities. And I speak solely for myself. You know, as a kid growing up in the projects, because of that union card I've carried in my wallet all these years, I've lived a life that I could not have imagined as a kid. My kids will never see the horrible that I grew up around, because the work I do was fairly compensated. I've had health security, been very fortunate. And I'm not bragging. I'm saying I want that for every working person. And we should want that. And this is a move in that direction. Because here's what's happened. And you know it as well as I do. We've turned into the two Americas. Working people are struggling just to keep up with the inflation shocks, to keep up with the rising cost of products, the gouging of corporate America. The CEO class, man, they're doing well. And I point to this guy who's the head of Procter & Gamble. His name is John Moeller. John got a 23% raise last year. Did you get a 23% raise last year alone? Now, this is him taking 23% increase and his workers getting an 8% decrease in wages. How's that happen? Well, it happens because these workers don't have bargaining power to sit down across the table from John there and say, wait a second, you got 23 million? You got a 23% raise and you want us to take a pay cut from you know, what, 60,000 down to, or from 69,000 down to 64,000? Explain that. So for me, this is a good thing. This is a step in the right direction, and I give the Biden administration credit, and I'm looking forward to moving on this in big ways. But I want to hear your thoughts. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I just see this as too big of a deal, but this could be a game changer. This could give us the working class economy that our grandparents' generation built. And, you know, as someone who's looking down the road going, you know, retirement may be coming soon. What am I going to leave my kids? This is a start. This is an opportunity to maybe do a little better than I did. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So let me ask you, you know, Nikki Haley becomes president. Do you think the woman who said that we've got the lowest unionization rate in South Carolina is because I wear pointy shoes and I kick those unions where it hurts? Do you think she's going to undo what the Biden administration has done to help working people? You bet your sweet. Fill in the blank. Okay. Because this is the woman who was on Bloomberg TV today, I believe it was. And she said that, you know, that retirement age at 65, way too low, way too low. I know. Sorry, kids. You know, we've done all this damage. We're not going to undo it. We've been doing damage to the economy for decades, to Social Security, to Medicare. You're just going to have to work longer for less and have less opportunities in the future. Sorry, that's just how it is. But understand, these folks, they hate working people. They probably couldn't find one if their life depended on it. Yet, working people vote for them. You could make the argument that Reagan, while one of the worst possible presidents for working people, at least was somewhere between the curbs, wasn't completely hostile to working people, at least could talk to them. This current Republican Party is not that party. And look, you know, there was that moment in the debate with Vivek Ramaswamy and Mike Pence, where, you know, Ramaswamy actually used the Morning in America frame as kind of a pejorative almost to attack the party, you know, basically saying, hey, Grandpa, we're not that party anymore. And it got me thinking about the current Republican Party, who unrecognizable to a Reagan type voter. Perfect example. I was reading this report of Tucker Carlson being in Hungary. And understand, he's someone who I question whose payroll he's on. I question whether he's on the Russian payroll, because here's a guy who, in my view, is anti-American, just period, flat out. Going on to foreign soil, saying that the Biden administration blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, going on foreign soil, saying that, that was an act of war, basically siding with someone else, saying, well, look what we did. And then saying that NATO is going to collapse because of the U.S. This kind of stuff, I'm sorry, the Republican Party that I grew up around, they wouldn't have stood for this. But this seems to be the mainstream thought right now of a lot of the Republican hierarchy. And it's a split within the party right now. I mean, they're struggling. Because you have this... And understand, this is on both sides. This is red hat, blue hat stuff. Where if one side is doing something and they're for it, the other side automatically, reflexively, has to be against it. And I've never lived in that kind of world. I'm a policy person. I want to know what your policies are. How are you going to use our government, the levers of power, to make lives better? And Republicans don't seem to have any of those levers. There's nothing that they bring to the table that I've seen yet. And I hope someone will say, no, Rick, they want to do all these wonderful things to help working people. It's just it's in a secret location. It's in an undisclosed secret location in a skiff somewhere. Maybe it exists. I haven't seen it. Maybe it is in Area 51 for all. Maybe the Martians have it. Because there's a lot more talk about aliens and Martians than there are about getting workers health care, getting workers decent benefits and decent wages and opportunities. There seem to be a lot more talk about aliens. But I look at this and I look at this moment where even you've got the Pope, you've got the freaking Pope talking about the backwardness of conservatives in America. Hello? The Pope? The guy who's supposed to have the red phone right upstairs? Saying, hey, you, How many red flags do we need? And this is where I keep coming back to talking about working people issues. All of the stuff that we're spoon-fed, all of the divisive stuff, all of the stuff that's meant to be reflexive, or if you're for this, you got to be against this. I prefer not to get engaged in that. Because what I know happens, and it's masterful, it works all the time, never fails. If you're distracting people with this nonsense, someone's robbing you blind. And I happened to be watching one of these videos over the weekend of a young woman talking about a silent depression. Now, her numbers, I think, were skewed. I'm not quite sure what orifice she pulled those numbers out. But her argument was during the depression, wages were adjusted for inflation higher than they are now. I wasn't able to corroborate her numbers, but when you looked at it, they were about the same. So when you start looking at the median income back during the depression, wages were lower, but we were in a freaking depression. And this is why I come back to this moment where Biden is doing good stuff. I wholeheartedly support the policies on the economic front, the manufacturing policy, the industrial policy, 100% behind it. And why I think this push today, this report today is important, because this is going to help working people catch up. I've said a bunch of times here on the program that, when I started in the less than truckload trucking industry, that job paid in today's money, $100,000 a year. It was incredibly good paying job because the industry was 85% unionized. You had mass density that you could raise the wages and the benefits and all of that stuff and make it a good, solid, middle-class, working-class job. Now it's just, you're getting by. So the anger that's out there is real. The frustration is real. People want to make sure that they have the ability to support themselves, their families, the future. But the wages haven't kept up. And there is a sense across all ideologies and all political lines, which is why I think that Oliver Anthony song was so important. And why it's driving the right and the left crazy, because here is a guy who's he's telling it like it is. We're struggling out here. And it's these people who, don't seem to listen, don't seem to care. And the anger that comes, the frustration that comes with that. Now, I have my left friend say, they're racist and homophobic. Probably. But what's that got to do with you and moving an economy forward to make sure everyone has opportunity? The more we divide ourselves, the more the wealth class of this country enjoys it, the happier they are. the more we allow ourselves to be pitted against each other, the less we get. And I've said this a thousand times. My government teacher in high school was very clear. We are the government, and government decides who gets what. So you got to ask yourself, you know, over the last 40 years, what have working people gotten? We've been trained to believe that government is the problem. And what built that working class of our grandparents' generation was an active government of, for, and by we, the working people. So for me, it seems pretty simple. I want a Joe Biden in the White House. I want Joe Biden's policies coming out of the White House. I want the people he's put in charge of regulatory bodies, ensuring that our air is safe, our water is safe, and our working conditions are safe. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Let's take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day 7,000 white and Filipino lettuce workers in California's Salinas Valley walked out on strike. Salinas was the lettuce capital of the world. The division of labor in the valley was largely ethnically based. Filipinos did much of the field labor, while whites worked in the packing sheds. At the time, Filipinos made up 40% of the total agricultural workforce in the Salinas Valley. They had founded the Filipino Labor Union a year earlier. White packing shed workers had organized into the AFL's Vegetable Packers Association. While the VPA had been reluctant to work with the FLU, they now sought to join forces in strike action. Both unions agreed neither would return to work until both had achieved victory. Together, they demanded wage increases, union recognition, and better working conditions. Losing $100,000 a day, the growers soon imported scabs of all races. They enlisted the California Highway Patrol to arrest striking Filipinos on incitement and vagrancy charges. Soon, the VPA agreed to arbitration, leaving the FLU to continue the strike alone. Some speculated the members were threatened with the loss of their charter if they refused to return to work. The striking Filipino workers continued to organize job actions and experienced increased retaliation as a result. VPA leaders publicly distanced themselves from the Filipino strikers, and racially charged vigilante violence intensified. It culminated in the burning down of the labor camp where hundreds of Filipino workers lived a month after the strike began. Vigilantes then drove as many as 800 Filipinos from the valley at gunpoint. The strike was officially called off, and those that remained returned to work. By October, both unions had won wage increases.
Peggy Lee struck a mournful chord with her hit song, Is That All There Is? It was about the vapidity of life, and I found myself subconsciously singing along last week as I pondered the GOP presidential debate. Of course, these made-for-TV spectacles are more akin to mud wrestling than actual policy debates. Still, I dared hope for some tiny element of civic seriousness. After all, the 8 aspirants were auditioning to be, oh say can you see, the next president of the United States. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, for example, stands out as a textbook example of the vapidity of modern American politics. A rampaging ego with no core democratic principles, no authentic persona, no speaking from the heart, and no possibility of being elected. Except that special interest powers have pumped him up with a couple $100 million to be their boy. Indeed, a strategy memo from DeSantis' own funders and consultants surfaced publicly just before last week's debate, confirming his vacuity as a candidate and a person. The detailed memo instructed him to avoid talking about policy solutions, to sledgehammer an opponent, to appear both for and against Trump, and maybe to show a little human emotion by talking about his kids. In short, he needs advisors to tell him how to be himself. DeSantis is hardly the first Who Am I candidate for the White House. Hillary Clinton's managers reintroduce her as the new real Hillary every couple of months in 2016, and Rick Perry's handlers tried to make him look smart by wearing horn-rimmed glasses. This is Jim Hightower saying, this lack of authenticity is now the norm, for it allows big money to shape candidates in its image. And that's why today's public policies are overwhelmingly based on what money wants, not on public need and honest principle.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm telling you, we're in a moment it's a whole new world. To steal the Reagan frame, it's morning again in America, if you will. You go back to last week with this announcement over the CEMEX thing, and now today with the report coming out saying, hey, you know what? Unions, they do raise wages. They do give people better benefits. This, all of this together is a big freaking deal. And here to share some thoughts on just how big this can and maybe is, I've asked our good friend Seth Goldstein to come talk with us. Seth is a partner at Julian Meyer Singla and Goldstein. They are one of the premier worker rights firms in the country. Seth, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much.
So Friday, what happened? Walk me through this announcement. Walk me through how important you think this is and what this could mean.
Well, on Friday, the NLRB made a seminal decision in CEMEX Cement, which was a case that involved the Teamsters. The general counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, used CEMEX to address three issues. One was Joyce Silk, which many of your listeners and viewers would remember involves voluntary recognition. The second one had to do with captive audience meetings, which was the Babcock-Wilcox case. And the third issue involved TriCasts. So the board passed on captive audience meetings and on TriCasts, but it did use the CEMEX decision to lay out a new framework for voluntary recognition. And it created a process for unions to request recognition and put the burden on the employer to demand a union election.
Right. But here's the thing, Seth, and this is what I've talked about for years. This is how our grandparents' generation organized. They took cards, they marched on the employer, and they sought recognition, and they started bargaining. There weren't these long, drawn-out periods of workers being harassed, intimidated, fired, and all of this stuff, as I understand it.
Well, it's my understanding, because I know that we have great organizers also, like in the 1930s and 40s, but back then, they had an ability to demand recognition, which is something that we lost probably around 50 years ago when the NLRB jettisoned Joyce Silk and came up with what was called the Gissel Framework.
And as I understand, part of the research that I've done on this, it was a misstatement that kind of made that the rule, the law of the land, wasn't it?
Yes. So what happened in the Supreme Court was the board attorney stated that the board had abandoned Joyce Silk, and then the court came up with what was called Gissel, which made it very, very difficult to get bargaining orders. And the significance here is that, and I think this scares management and the union busters because they've been attacking me all day on LinkedIn and Twitter, is that if they commit any unfair labor practice violations, then they're subject to a bargaining order.
Yeah, maybe don't break the law, Seth. Maybe don't do it.
Exactly. But there was no consequences previously, because previously all they had was a rerun of the election. So they could union bust all they wanted And then they faced a union election, which they had fired everybody and, you know, basically coerced people into silence. Right. And that is something that the union busters and the law firms are worried about. I know that Morgan Lewis, who represents Trader Joe's and Amazon, is freaking out about this because they put out their strategy statement, you know, online. I posted about it because they're now saying that they're going to demand copies of everybody's names that signed on to union cards, which we know is a violation of the law. But, you know, desperate people do desperate things.
But here's the thing, and this is what I just said a moment ago. You know, in the environment before Friday, if you're one of these union busting firms, it would be, you know, malpractice to not tell an employer to break the rules, to not tell an employer to fire someone, because the penalties were so pathetic. And as you said, you know, the recourse was, oh, you just run another election, but without all of the people who were your most ardent supporters. So there was no downside. This adds a little bit of downside and balance, which is why I think this could be a game changer.
Absolutely. Previously, before Jennifer Abruzzo, all you got was a posting in the break room. That's all you got.
Yeah, the dreaded notice.
And you know, people, you know, said it's like toilet paper.
Yeah, I won't do it again until the next time.
Right. And they would sign things, and you know, Amazon did that for a while. You know, they signed national settlement agreements that they knew they weren't going to keep, and so the board has come up with a really incredible framework with CMEX, but that's not in isolation, because last week they also came up with the final rules for the quick elections too. And, you know, before the board is also captive audience, you know, reconsiderations of Babcock Wilcox and TriCast, which is the ability for the employer to lie during a union campaign. So all these things, I believe, are going to really help a lot. But of course, it takes a union, you know, they have to be willing to adapt to new organizing strategies and collective action.
Right. And politics as well. Look, I mean, you know, I've got a lot of my union friends say, well, you know, unions shouldn't be involved in politics. No, they should, because this is political. This is only happening because Joe Biden is in the White House. I don't care if you do agree with me or not. This is happening because of one guy who put one person in charge to move this in the right direction. And that's why I voted for Joe Biden.
Well, I have to tell you that him and I will be knocking doors for Joe Biden because of this decision. And I urge everyone to remember the consequences of not having a pro-labor president or pro-labor NLRB. And, you know, I came of age during Ronald Reagan, you know, with PACO and every presidency that the Republicans had, the board law got worse and worse. You could see decisions. I think one was issued by Judge Green, and it's amazing how many anti-union decisions came out of the NLRB in the 1980s with Reagan, and even before that with Nixon. So it is very refreshing to have a pro-labor NLRB, a pro-labor Department of Labor.
And I hope come 2024 we keep this, because, you know, while we're celebrating this return to sanity, Nikki Haley gets into the White House, let's say, the woman who said, you know, we've had the lowest union density in South Carolina because she wears pointy toes and kicks unions where it hurts. Do you think she's going to allow that to stand? Of course not.
Nope. And I think that, you know, we've seen that what happens when a right-wing government is in place in the United States. People lose all their rights. There was also a policy that they had at the NLRB that if a union organizer that was fired talked to the press, their case would go to Washington to the general counsel's office during the Trump presidency, never to be heard of again. And that was like a non-disclosure agreement for union organizers, because if they talked, they would, you know, their case would die. So yes, we've had a lot of great things with Jennifer Abruzzo, and this week I think there's going to be some other great decisions.
No, it's what we need. Now, you know, you listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Seth Goldstein. Seth is a partner at Julian Meyer Singla, and Goldstein, as I said, they're one of the premier worker centric firms in the country, doing some great work on workers' rights issues. Now, you're, you know, attached to the Amazon labor union folks in New York. I was talking about this kind of a thing back when Amazon in Birmingham was doing all of the unfair labor practices and got away with it. I mean, ultimately, you know, harassing people while they're going to the bathroom, you know, putting, you know, cameras everywhere, the ballot box being a mailbox with cameras everywhere, the police harass. I mean, there was just tons of stuff. And I remember saying at the time, this is where the NLRB has to step in and say, you know what? You've screwed up so badly, you're going to have to now bargain. And I'm glad to see that this has happened. Was that a big part of this, do you think?
I think so. I mean, Bessemer was certainly an issue. I would agree with you.
Now, obviously, you guys in New York, the Amazon Labor Union and the folks that you're attached with, they won their election, but still, all of the harassment, all of the intimidation, this is where I keep coming back to, should workers have to put up with that kind of abuse simply because they want to earn a better wage and have better health care and better opportunities for themselves and their families? I guess that's a central question that we have to all ask ourselves, isn't it?
Yes. I think that Amazon has gotten away with a lot. Well, the one thing I would like to see with Amazon is not just the NLRB taking action, but also state governments taking action on their tax abatements. And I also do think that the Biden administration should review their contracts and put pressure on Amazon to, you know, to meet and bargain with ALU. Now, there is a roadmap to this. We see that in Starbucks, Cornell University, because of student pressure, was forced to drop their contract with Starbucks. And I believe that that's starting up at other college campuses. That type of grassroots effort, I think, would go a long way of putting pressure on Amazon.
Yeah, no, that brings me back to the idea of secondary boycotts, which are illegal since Taft-Hartley. I mean, you know, I go back to my grandparents. It was societal. It was every working person understood how important unions were, even if they weren't involved or members of a union, because they understood someone was fighting for their best interests. Do you see us, you know, this being part of moving us back in that kind of societal shift that we once had?
I do. I don't think what is happening with Cornell is a secondary boycott. I think this people are really just tired of the fact that that, you know, their university or their employer deals with companies that are just human rights violators, and that's just freedom of association.
I agree with you on that, but I brought that up as, you know, this is a tool that was used in the past by my grandparents' generation, and a lot of it had to do with the people in society who said,
absolutely,
you know what, we're just not going to participate, or we're going to stand with our workers in this at this other company, which, you know, I think is infectious.
Yeah, I think that we are going back to that, where people are standing together, and I think that is the central premise that is happening. And I think it's being fueled by millennials, Gen Z workers who, you know, think that they should be treated with decency and respect. So
yeah, but coming out of the pandemic, Seth, I mean, you know, every person was told you're an essential, you're a hero, you're all this stuff. Nobody wants to go back to being treated like crap for poverty wages, and especially now that inflation is putting a pinch on every working person, and you were seeing these corporate profits that are obscene, these CEOs that are lining their pockets. This is a perfect time for this.
Right. So I think that you see this happening all over the country. I will also remark that I have represented undergraduate workers, and they're taking a stand. Like tomorrow, I have a shout out to the OPEIU workers for Local 153 at Tufts University. There, the undergrads RAs are going to be striking during move-in day. So this is happening everywhere. It's very, very exciting.
No, this the kind of activity is good stuff, and hopefully it builds, and we build an economy that we can be proud of. Last question I've got for you. You know, you've said this CEMEX decision is a big deal. Who's going to be the first one to use it?
Trader Joe's United. We filed today a CEMEX bargaining order, and we are moving forward to challenge the tied election that we had in New York in April. We believe that we had a substantial majority going into the election, and because of union busting, it had ended up in a 76-76 tie. So we're going in there with the demand that Trader Joe's and union busting Morgan Lewis recognize our union and go to the bargaining table.
Well, this will be something for us to watch out for. This will be the test case, and I wish you guys the best. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again when the good news comes down.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the time, Seth. Thanks so much. Seth Goldstein, he is a partner over at Julian Meyer Signal and Goldstein. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. This is a big deal? I think it is. Right back after this.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day one of the most important stands for justice and equality took place in United States history. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech to a 250,000 people in Washington, D.C. But did you know that one of the main organizers for the march was a man by the name of Baird Rustin? Rustin is often left out of the history books because he was gay and because of his earlier communist affiliations. He was born in 1912 and raised in Westchester, Pennsylvania. He was raised in the Quaker tradition, and his commitment to peaceful, nonviolent protest continued into the civil rights movement. Rustin joined the Young Communist League in the 1930s, a time when communist organizers were some of the few people actively speaking out about racial injustice in the United States. After he left the Young Communist League, Rustin spent a brief time as an organizer for a march on Washington, D.C., planned in the 1940s. This movement was led by one A. Philip Randolph. The planned march was aimed at putting pressure on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to desegregate work at industries with federal wartime manufacturing contracts. When President Roosevelt agreed to issue an order desegregating these jobs, the planned march was called off. But the idea for the march lived on and became a reality during the civil rights movement. Rustin went on to work in the labor movement. He became the founder and first director of the AFL-CIO's A. Philip Randolph Institute, which focuses on tearing down the walls of discrimination in workplaces and within the labor movement.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Got an email from Darren from North Carolina, who's asking about, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, who he says whose primary talking point seems to be about firing people. Darren writes, I just can't understand how any candidate can get more than two supporters with the message of firing people. He says, as I recall, he wanted Elon Musk to be an advisor, not because of some technological advancement or expertise, but because he fired a lot of people. Donald Trump claim to fame on The Apprentice with the catchphrase, you're fired. Just tell me, Rick, explain to me how you're fired is a popular policy position. It boggles the mind. And I'll tell you, it boggles my mind too. The only thing I can say is the cruelty is the point. The folks who would be drawn to that, the cruelty is the point, because they don't believe it's going to be them until it is. And then it's catastrophic. Then it's the victim card. You can see this playing out in time after time after time, because they've been fed by right-wing talk radio that they're special. Everybody else is worthless. Everybody else is no good. The others are taking from them. And part of what this latest kind of anger has been is that crowd is waking up to the reality that life hasn't turned out the way that they expected, the way we believed it was supposed to. And now they're doubling down on blaming the others. So the cruelty of you're fired, that's enticing. I get it to them. I don't get it for me, but I get it for them. It's twisted. But I appreciate the email, Darren. Thanks so much. Interesting news today. And I thought about this today a bit on how I was going to handle it. Because Joe, the unlicensed plumber, Samuel Wolfsbacher, he passed away today. Died of pancreatic cancer. He was 49 years old. Now, for those who remember Joe, the unlicensed plumber, he was a right-wing darling for about 15 minutes. Ran against Marcy Kaptur out in Toledo and lost, fortunately. I met Joe the Unlicensed Plumber here in Harrisburg, you know, back when they were the right-wing moneyed people were putting him all over the place to beat up on labor unions. And he was like the front person for the whole secret ballot election thing, and you know how they were fighting against the Employee Free Choice Act, and he was one of the loudest anti-union voices. And when he came to Harrisburg, I'm going to argue that I saved his life back then so that he would at least live more years, because he came to Harrisburg with his fake voting booth that it would allow no one to vote, because the unions had a bunch of people there who were willing to go vote and say, yeah, we want card check. We want to be able to do what past generations have been able to do to organize. So they wouldn't let anybody vote, and they were going to go to Philly afterwards. And I had the opportunity to interview him and talk to him for about 15-20 minutes. And I said, I told him, don't go to Philly. You're not going to fare well. The people here are mostly supportive. Don't go to Philly. And he didn't. And that was one of those things I say, I kind of saved him. But here's the scary part of this. Here is someone his entire life advocated, you're your own guy. Don't worry about licensing requirements. Don't worry about anything. Just go do it. So as an unlicensed plumber, he was doing plumbing work. He actually got a job at the Jeep plant in Toledo, a UAW job. I don't know what happened after the big news of that. But we find out a couple of months ago that he's diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I see the fundraising request to raise money, and they said, look, as a community of friends, we have set up this medical campaign to support Joe and Katie during these months when Joe is not able to work. I gotta know, what kind of health care did Joe have? He couldn't work. Did the employer pick it up? These are a lot of these questions that I gotta tell you. I had mixed emotions today. I don't wish anyone ill. I don't wish him. I mourn for his family. This is bad. But what he advocated for was horribly destructive, and not just for himself, but for society as a whole. Now, look, I get he made some money. He was a media figure for a little bit. Wasn't able to take it to that next step. But think of the fact that this is a guy who was the face of stopping the Employee Free Choice Act from happening, which I advocated for solely because of first contract arbitration. Because the one thing with this CMEQ decision is that, yeah, you're going to be able to get union recognition, but are you going to ever get a first contract? There's so much more down the road that has to happen. Yeah, you're going to get recognized as a bargaining unit, but the employer's just never going to bargain in good faith. There'll be thousands of meetings to cross I's and dot T's, or cross T's and dot I's, and nothing substantial happening because we don't have the legislation to mandate it. And the moneyed interest knew what they were doing with him. They used him as a divisive figure.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.